Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been around since 1982, and we're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Let me just drop, and I'll give you the usual information. As always, if anyone is interested in either suggesting a question or a topic, or they have a puzzle and they can't get onto the TechNet itself, we have an email address. Also, if you'd like me to tap Paul, WS2N, with the space report on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a space-related news story, the easiest email address to reach us is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And as always, I make available links on my link page. I have one link related to, I think, a story that Paul will give you later on during his SpaceNet report and with some nice pictures in it. So please take a look at that when you have the time. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. You just type that into your URL in your browser, and it'll take you to the link page. We have a chat room available. You can either get there by going through the Limark.org website, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll take you there. And as always, I am streaming this on the Internet, again, for people who don't have access to either IRLP or Echolink or a regular radio. You can reach it by just typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. Again, the Internet audio link is technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, Mike, KC2NJI, maintains an excellent archive site. His website is amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Technical Net that go all the way back to September of 2006. So please check it out. Let me drop for a second, and I will continue. Okay, once again, we will be asking if anyone has any questions or topics or comments to make of a technical nature. I ask them for their first name and their call sign. And we'll write down a list, and hopefully we'll go down the list and discuss the topics or questions from listeners. Somewhere between 8:30, 9 o'clock, Andy will be back again with Andy's Corner. He will be discussing the nuances of impedance matching devices for antennas, and we look forward to that. When he's done, I will return to finish up any questions I hadn't gotten to, ask if anyone has any further questions, and I have a list of articles or little bits and pieces of factoids that I picked up that we'll see if the audience wants to discuss them. And then at approximately 10:15, Paul, WS2N, will be on with the SpaceNet Report. That will probably go up to about 11 p.m., and then we will wish everyone well until next Sunday. So let this all begin. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. And if you have any questions of a technical nature, if you have any topics or statements or something appropriate for a technical net, please give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2GS, this is... KC2DAW, supporting the net.
K2GJE, and only a comment.
Okay, anyone else with any questions, topics, or comments tonight? Give me your name and your call sign. Okay. DAW, did you have a question, or you did you just want to say hello and check into the net?
Oh, sorry. The name here is Curtis, and I was just supporting the net. KC2DAW.
Okay, so be it, Curtis. Ed, K2GJE, you had a comment you wanted to make, please.
Oh, good evening. Just a comment on what I was investigating last Sunday. I wanted to know about the matching network for a 5/8 whip. And it's not complicated. I got help. I was told that the 5/8 whip is capacitive. And there seems to be some different opinions on how capacitive. But at any rate, all it needs is a very small coil at the base. I calculated two coils of different diameters. And to counteract the capacitive 5/8 whip. Let me stand down for a moment. Okay. K2GJE, Ed. There's a very simple formula that I've used over the years for calculating an inductor. I think it used to be in the handbooks. I don't know. I haven't purchased a handbook in a while. And what I did years ago, I just programmed it into Excel. And anytime I needed a coil, I would just plug in numbers and get an answer without having to use a calculator. And I don't know if maybe you might post it on your site. I could give it to you. It's a very simple formula, and if you put it into Excel, it's absolutely nothing. And I calculated two different coils based upon what forms you might have around for 147 megacycle 5/8 wave whip. Over.
Very good, Ed. I'm curious what kind of reactants you decided upon, because I did a little bit of looking around the websites, and the capacitive reactants of a 5/8 comes out to a bunch of different numbers, apparently. I think it's somewhat dependent upon what antenna design program you use and how you design the radials around them. I've seen as much as 420 ohms of capacitive reactance and as little as 250 ohms of capacitive reactance. So what number did you go with?
K2GJE. I went with 425. My calculations were based on 425, and that came up with 0.465 microhenries. Over.
Okay, very good. Like I said before, it's very odd that seems to be a 2x range for published results, but 425 was kind of the higher end that struck me as probably the more believable. But it's curious that there are different numbers on the internet. So do you want to share your equation? What I'm going to do probably is post a link to a website that goes into it, because my ability to do equations is somewhat limited on my link page.
K2GJE, the equation that I use, and I've used it over the years very successfully. I even used another program to check it, and I came up with exactly the same number of microhenries. So the one that I like is inductance equals N squared with n being the number of turns, times d squared, with d being the diameter of the form that you're using, divided by 18 times d plus 40 times L. And then you have to adjust by the answer that you get with the number of decimal places. You have to adjust if it's millihenries or microhenries by seeing if it's six places or three places. Over.
Okay, Ed. The D in the third expression, is that the same D that you're squaring? Ed, did you hear my question? I'm a little confused by the use of the letter D. I assume the diameter of the form. It's in the upper portion of the equation, n squared times d squared, but it's also in the denominator, 18 times d.
Okay, I lost you. I don't know what happened here. I'll give the equation again. It's in the numerator and the denominator. I like to use a lot of parentheses so that you don't get confused. The top is n squared times d squared and divided by 18d plus 40l. There is a much longer formula for this, but they resolved it to the 18 and the 40, which seems to make everything come out very easy for you. Over.
Okay, very good. So it's n squared times d squared over 18d times 40l, which is, I guess, the length of the coil.
Plus 40l.
Okay, sorry, plus 40l. Now, I assume that the actual diameter of the wire doesn't factor into this type of equation?
The diameter of the wire doesn't factor in on this one. I do have another equation where the diameter of the wire factors in, but they recommend you use a large diameter wire, maybe 14 or 12 gauge, so that the losses are minimal. But probably if you're not using much power, I don't think it makes much difference if you used even a lower gauge. And I solved it for two coils based upon what you have on hand. There's a lot of pieces of plastic you can get your hands on. One was four turns on a one-inch diameter, and it comes out about 3/8 of an inch in length. And another one was seven turns on a half-inch diameter, and it comes out half-inch long. And you stretch the coil to conform to this. And then later on, you could use some RTV or some Duco cement or something to nail it down. Or another way gets a little involved, though. You take a piece of flat plastic and you drill offset holes and you thread the magnetic wire through the holes. Over.
WA2CDL.
Yes, Andy.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that, you know, that formula that you're giving is a standard formula for air-wound coils. So any air-wound coil, you just wind a coil that without any material in the center of it. That's the standard formula, as you just said. And where the inductance is in microhenries, and the D is the diameter of the coil in inches. And L is the coil length, and N is the number of turns. So given those factors, you take a coil, you know the number of turns, you know the diameter, you measure it, and you know the length of it. your answer will be Michael Henry is using that formula that you said, so I just wanted to clarify that. That's a standard formula. I think it's even in the question on one of the tests, the amateur radio exams. Just to mention that. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. I don't think they ask those types of questions anymore. It's been about 9 years since I took my exams, but I also proctor them, and I haven't kind of seen them. They probably asked that in the good old days. In the really old days, I'm told they used to ask you to draw things like Colpitt's oscillator circuit schematics, complete with the value of each of the components. Nowadays, it's just multiple choice.
Colpitts, Hartley, Pierce, electron coupled, and all the other oscillators that, I remember all that stuff. It's in the old radio amateur's license manuals that you used to study back in the 60s. To take the test, all those questions, yes. All right, anyway, back to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy, and thank you, Ed. I've already put up on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, a link to a page that shows Ed's equation and actually has a built-in calculator, so you don't even have to do multiplication and division. You just plug in the numbers and you get the answer. But thank you very much, Ed. It's always good to have equations like that readily available. You never know when you're going to make your own inductance coil. I'm sure more people did that in the good old days. I still see people needing to do it for little things like tuned circuits for QRP devices and such. So there's still it's still good to learn or to sharpen your skill sets of how to make inductors because they're still very useful for us hams. Okay, that being done, let me once again ask if anyone out there has come up with any questions or topics tonight. We do have a little bit more time before Andy's Corner, I would guess, so if you want to avail yourself of this time, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KG2RY, David.
Yes, David.
QSL, I was going through eBay. I bought a device. It's a communications device. It is full duplex and HD audio. You have to get some kind of plan, you know, to get the network. And the communications device is very inexpensive, and so is the plan. I know it's not ham radio, but it is RF. And I guess, you know, the one really good thing about it is that the battery is very big, you know. You could run it for 25 days of standby time.
Well, that's interesting. It really depends upon what kind of circuits are used, more efficient, less efficient, and its ability to kind of go into a very low-power sleep mode. I'm a little confused by what exactly it is. You say it's RF. Are you saying it's a high-definition audio? Is it some kind of a broadcast music mode? I'm not quite sure what it is.
Negative, negative. You know, I've told a couple of people about this on the DMR, and they said, well, you know, I've been playing around in the 1.2 gigahertz that they had a full duplex, high definition ham radio communication, you know. But this device only costs $55 on eBay, and to keep it on, you know, the network is about $25 a month.
Okay. Still not quite sure what it might be. If you have the time and you have a link, you can always send it to me. You know my email address, and I'll take a look at it. Again, you know, sort of ultimately these things depend upon the circuits used. You know, some circuit technology is much more efficient than others. You know, CMOS is a very, very energy efficient solid state integrated circuit design. Some of those things can go into standby mode and use a milliwatt or even less just to sustain itself until it needs to kind of wake itself up. So it's sort of fascinating how long some devices can go into standby mode, especially ones that don't require energy-hungry output devices like screens. There's no way to really do that with a screen, which is why Apple watches and other electronic watches have a relatively limited lifespan, simply because they use up a lot of juice just maintaining the screen in one way or another.
Yeah, but, you know, you can get an Apple iPhone and you can pay $450 for it, you know. The iPhone SE 2020, and it has a puny little battery in there, you know. So you can leave it on standby when the battery is new, maybe 2.5-3 days, that's it. And you pay so much money for that, you know. So I opted to look into a device and a plan that's really inexpensive and actually works better in most cases than Verizon.
Okay, so you're talking about a cell phone, I gather.
Well, you know, I was looking at those iFinder DMR Android digital phones, you know, and they're very expensive, and I don't know, maybe they're also considered PTT phones, you know? So I looked around for PTT phones, and I found one, you know, for like $50, made by a company called Sonim. It's like a man's phone. They say it's a man's phone, because all you really do on it is talk. You don't, like, do internet or get data. You don't use data. It's only for talking, you know, so it's a talk phone.
Okay, that makes sense. What you're alluding to is RF Finder. They're the people that make the repeater lists and such. They went into the business of a Android-based cell phone that also was capable of operating on amateur radio bands. So it looks like a Android cell phone, but it has the added ability to communicate on repeaters and on the amateur radio bands. And it costs a reasonably large amount of money. I believe QST just reviewed it this month. You know, that I think goes for a grand or something. I don't know of anyone who actually owns one. As you were mentioning iPhones, the SE phone is their lower cost models. They just announced the iPhone 12, and some models, some versions of that, the Pro Large, or however they call the large version of the Pro, you know, cost more than $1,000. So there's a big range. If you don't need the whiz-bang nature of the phone, if you don't need smartphone capability, applications and all that, and all you need is to talk to a person, then you could probably get a much less expensive phone. Not, you know, wouldn't call it a smartphone, but some people just need a phone to communicate. In the old days, that's all that the phones were. Nowadays, younger people often carry very expensive smartphones and never actually talk to anyone on them. They text them, they send them videos, they do all kinds of things, but very seldom do they actually talk on a phone.
One question. First, did you hear of anybody who has used the iFinder, whether they like it or not? And the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, the iPhone SE is for everything but talking, you know, and the talk phone is for talking. So basically two phones, you know, cover the gamut.
Well, it's my understanding that, that smartphones do also include talking. People use them for making regular phone calls. I've used mine for regular phone calls. I'm just pointing out that, that younger people, for some reason, don't have the enjoyment of talking on the phone as much as us old folk, and they tend to prefer texting and using other means through the same exact device. I didn't have a chance to read the QST review of the item. Most of what I've picked up in the past treats the RF Finder Android-based Handy Talkie as more of a curiosity than something that they think time has come. So I'm not quite sure if this is a cultural problem or that the addition of ham frequencies to a cell phone kind of serves a purpose for our community. You know, it'd be interesting to see. It might simply be that the price point is wrong. You know, most amateur radio operators are not really easy with their wallets. And to ask people to spend $1,000 for a glorified phone when they can just strap a Baofeng to whatever they're using to make telephone calls, you know, sometimes that's enough of an impediment.
Well, you know, I think the most significant part of the phone, the device itself, you know, when you buy, you know, an Apple product or an Android product or whatever it is, you know, the chip and the circuitry is less important than one thing. Do you know what that is?
I would assume the function.
Negative, it's the battery. You know, your battery only has a certain amount of time. You know, it's operable. Eventually, it putters out, you know. If you have a phone with a puny little battery in it, you know, then you're not going to get so much life, you know. And also, you know, if you talk a lot, you'll burn up your battery. Or if you stream audio or if you stream video, you know, you will use up your battery. So I opted for a phone that just for talking. And it has 25 hours of straight talk time. So the battery is huge in there, you know. I think battery is probably, you know, the thing, the deal breaker for me.
AC2GS. Well, it depends on the individual. You know, battery life is very important, but functionality is just as important to other people, maybe not you. They like all those features. They like having a camera available. They like being able to watch videos and share videos and do all kinds of things that drain their batteries. And in most cases, they're willing to take a hit on the battery life, either by recharging it more regularly or by carrying a secondary rechargeable battery that plugs into one of the ports on the cell phone and gives it a little bit extra juice. So it sort of depends upon the individual. Some people like to keep it simple, and other people like to keep it complicated.
I hear you, but let's say, you know, you have rented the phone for 2 years, you know. By the end of 2 years, your battery becomes inoperable. It just doesn't work anymore. So you have to take it to the insured repair, you know, and they give you a new battery, but you don't want to keep the phone because it's old already, you know. So, yeah, I think battery plays a big part in it, you know. And if I don't talk on the smartphone, I can talk on this cheap, inexpensive talk phone, then, you know, I extend the operable battery life of the iPhone.
To a degree, you know, nothing is simple, unfortunately, in this world. The lifespan of a battery has a lot to do with number of recycles, but it also has to do with how long it's charging, if it's overheating, occasionally poor design. I've had more than a few iPhones that I've needed to get battery replacements, not because the batteries failed, but because they expanded in their chassis so much that it pushed the screen out. So I've had to do that more than a few times, unfortunately. And it's not from excessive recycling it. It's probably from leaving it in the charger longer than it should have been kept. But, again, it depends upon the individual. Some people, a very simple burner phone is all that they need. Some people still like to play with flip phones. They've made very expensive flip phones in the last few years that I think are a little bit on the overpriced because they use really bleeding-edge technology of flexible screens so that you can actually fold the screen in half, and that's what's doing the flipping nowadays. But then they end up charging you something ridiculous like $1,200 for it. But, you know, like all things, if your needs are simple, then certainly go with a simple burner phone, prepaid even, if that works for you. And other people will line up in Apple stores to buy $1,200 phones and trade them in or just get rid of them every year and upgrade so that, God forbid, they never have last year's model. You know, whatever floats your boat, as long as none of these people come to me for part of the money, of course.
Yeah, I think most of it is hype, you know, most of the sales pitch. You buy it or you don't buy it. I was reading a couple of places that it's best that when your phone goes down to 20% charge, that you charge it to about 90 or 95%. Not all the way to 100. If you leave it on at 100, you might be doing damage to your phone and your battery. So, you know, I keep an eye on the phone. And if it goes down to 20%, then I bring it up to 95%. And that seems to work pretty well.
Comment, WHCDO.
Yes, Andy.
Yeah, it's an interesting question that Dave is bringing up because there's so many types of batteries out there, and battery technology has really changed over the past number of years a lot, you know, given all the portable devices, cell phones and everything else that we carry with us, and, you know, so they had to come up with ways of extending the life. So there's a question. I just looked this up. It's kind of interesting. It's most people will ask, how long will my battery last? So if you buy a cell phone, how long will it last? What's the lifespan? They answer it this way. The real question is, though, not how long batteries last, but how long they should batteries last. I guess the word should is emphasized. See, batteries basically have three distinct measures of life. You have your run time, your shelf life, and your cycle life. And, of course, that depends on the chemistry of the battery. And each type of battery chemistry has a different answer. You have alkaline, you have lithium, polymer, and, you know, the list goes on and on. So it's complicated. That's a complicated question as far as, you know, if you wanted to just buy something based on the battery that's powering it. They manufacture, in my opinion, when you buy a cell phone, these batteries are designed, I guess what I'm trying to say is the cell phone is designed and the battery is designed to match the particular cell phone. But they know exactly how much current draw the cell phone is going to cause or draw from that battery on the highest power for that particular phone. So, you know, they come up with the type of battery that's going to last the longest. The actual time, I don't have an answer for. But I guess that's what you're asking, Dave, as far as, you know, being concerned about the battery that's being used in a particular device. And it shouldn't be too concerning because, again, you know, these batteries are designed for the device, in my opinion, and will last, you know, a number of years before there's any issues. I think, let me let it drop, hold on. I think there might even be some revs, revisions, and upgrades to the phone, which will come sooner before the battery actually goes bad. And they do go bad. You know, batteries, will, as Roy just mentioned, batteries will explode, they'll overheat, they'll catch fire and do all sorts of crazy things. But you don't hear too many reports of this. I think that batteries, battery technology is really, again, has advanced to the point. Anyway, that was just an overview, an overthought question that I just thought I'd bring out. Roy, do you agree with what I'm saying? Back to you.
AC2GS. Yes, Andy, I agree with you. For the most part, thermal runaway is not terribly serious. You'll hear about it almost every time it happens because it makes the news. Usually you just get failures or you get volume expansion causing problems. I've even had laptops where the plug-in lithium polymers would no longer really fit well into their slot because they had expanded just beyond the capacity to hold them. Yeah, it also depends upon the technology, as you mentioned. In the bad old days of nickel-cadmium had a really bad problem called the memory effect, so that if you didn't charge it to 100%, if you for some reason charged it to 95 or 90 or 80 or 70, after a few dozen cycles like that, you couldn't get it past that low point. So if you were charging it up to 75% all the time, you would never see 76 or 77. That was the memory effect. Lithium ion, lithium polymer does not have that effect. So what usually is recommended among the manufacturers is if you're not going to use your battery in the next few days, you should only charge it to somewhere between 50% and, say, 70% capacity. At that level, it'll slowly self-discharge over time, but it's better to be stored with a partial charge than a total maximum charge or in a discharged way. So each of the chemistries have its own little nuances.
Can I add to this question? Because I got some answers.
Certainly.
Yeah, because, you know, for Dave's sake, I'll... Because I'm reading something, you know, I'm doing this stuff online. You know, all this information is on the internet. The internet is great. I mean, there's so many things you can search and Google. You have any questions? You know, they come up with so many different answers and YouTube videos. It's all over the place, which is great. You know, it's at your fingertips. I'm just a quick rundown. We're gonna just, you know, categorize the batteries as the non-rechargeable type and the rechargeable type. And according to what I'm reading here, the alkaline you know, is the most common, which everybody knows the name. And as a non-rechargeable battery, it says it has a shelf life of 5 to 10 years when stored at room temperature. Now, we know that, you know, heat destroys things. So you got to make sure you don't put it into a hot environment. And there is no cycle life for alkaline batteries since they are not rechargeable. They're not rechargeable, so there's no cycle life. In fact, it says charging them is unsafe and is not recommended. Just moving forward, you have your carbon zinc. Everybody knows carbon zinc. You know, your old standard dry cell battery with your carbon rod in the middle. And that's, you know, that's an early design of a battery. Let me let it drop. Stand by. Yes, you know, carbon zinc batteries are cheap batteries. They're not as expensive, but they also have less capacity, you know, as far as the ampere hour capacity. And also they leak. And it says in the past we're prone to leakage. How many times have you left a carbon zinc battery in your flashlight for like a year or two or a couple of months, and all of a sudden, you know, you want to use your flashlight, it doesn't go on, and you see all this gooey stuff coming out of it. I've had that. And, you know, it's an acid. It's acidic. It causes green stuff to form. I don't know which chemical it is. The green oxide to form on the contacts. And sometimes you got to use a neutralizer to remove it. So that's the carbon zinc. And then you got your lithium. You have your lithium non-rechargeables. And it says our experience with them is that lithium non-rechargeables, they last 10 to 12 years. So that's a much better battery because of the lifespan. And that's as far as the shelf life of the battery. And it says factors that determine shelf life is the quality of the manufacturing process, the chemical composition, and et cetera. Manufacturers recommend a shelf life of 10 years at 70 degrees. In some instances, lithium ion rechargeable batteries have lasted up to 20 years. So that's your non-rechargeables. Then your rechargeable types, you have your NiCad, your nickel cadmiums, your nickel metal hydride, which NiMH, nickel metal hydride batteries, and lithium rechargeables, and lead acid, because everybody knows lead acid in cars, and so on. So that's basically, I didn't go into all the details, but basically that's a rundown of the type of batteries. All right, Rory, back to you. Sorry, I just wanted to add that. WHCDO.
No reason to be sorry, Andy. I appreciate the further information. In addition, although zinc carbon batteries can link, leak. Also, alkaline batteries can and often do. I'm sure people listening have opened up a flashlight or something with their Eveready alkalines or their Duracell alkalines and found that corrosive material. Whereas carbon zinc is acid-based and the material is acidic and corrosive, the alkalines have a alkaline corrosive material that weeps out of it and can corrode contacts and such.
You know, I had this experience. I had lithium ion rechargeable batteries in an old phone. It was called Galaxy Note 4, made by Samsung. And I kept that phone for as long as I could. And it had one feature that made it really good. And that was, if a battery no longer functions, you can just pull the back off, put another one in there. You know, I guess most of the new phones, they don't allow for you to change the battery. But the Sonim Talk phone that I'm talking about, I can change the battery, and I have three of them. You know, first one seems to be working really well, and it's also a very big battery. It's like a brick. I guess maybe that would be a good feature for new phones, but for some reason they don't allow anyone to access the battery inside the case.
My assumption for why that is the case, and it is very common, is that they're sort of looking at the consumer's lust after a slim, thin design. You can build a slimmer cell phone, unfortunately, by making the battery not easily removable. The insides are practically glued together. It's really not meant to be changed by customers. It's only techs that can fiddle around with it and take it apart. But I think that's the problem. They don't want a big, bulky phone. Most people like their phones relatively slim. You know, some like them small, some like them enormous, but they all end up liking them with a slimmer profile.
82AMZ with a comment.
Yes, Mike.
Well, thank you. That's a very good argument. I work with a lot of people. Yes, they claim the form factor for cell phones. Excuse me. I got my Android phone, and it's slim, and it does have a removable battery. Remember, this trend was started by Apple, who designed their devices with a non-removable lithium-ion battery. As an engineer, that's abysmal. But as an accountant and bean counter, quite frankly, a little dollar signs went off. Now you got to buy a new phone all the time. And remember the last fiasco when the batteries, I forget which iPhone it was, they reached a certain lifespan number that the cell phone would automatically start to degrade itself by forcing it to a bad mode of operation after a certain period. So force you. Money, that's the bottom line.
Well, I agree with you, Mike, that money does play an important part. Again, if people weren't easygoing with this and demanded removable batteries, although probably they'd lose a couple of milliamp hours, just the nature of things, the market would make allowances and they'd come up with these things. I've had laptops that have built-in batteries, and after I realized my mistake, I make it a point of all my laptops and tablets that I can get with exchangeable batteries, I do. I stay away from Microsoft Surface because they went in whole hog on that type of thing. So, you know, you make your decisions. Apple, I'm sure, made money. You can get replacement batteries, either legitimately through Apple. It's not horrendous. You know, something like $65 it cost me to ship it to them, put a new battery in and ship it back. And if I get another 2 years of life, it's worth it. You don't necessarily have to chuck your phone if the battery fails. But I can understand you feeling that way.
When you sent your phone back to Apple, did they send you back your original phone or somebody else's with the memory wiped?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a complicated answer, sort of, but I'll give it to you as short as I can. I have two iPhones. One is still connected to a telephone line. That's the X. And one is an older model that I stopped using as a phone and just use it as a smart device, and that's a iPhone 6. I sent both back because they both had battery bulge. One went to one center, the other went to another center. They didn't apparently have a problem with the iPhone X. They wiped its memory and sent it back to me. The 6, they were very weird about. They said, we swapped the battery, but we couldn't boot it up. We couldn't run it. It doesn't work. It's broken. So either we want you to approve a credit card payment of $350 to fix it, or we could junk it and recycle it, or we can put it back in the box and ship you the broken one. So being suspicious, I asked them to ship me my broken one. When I got it out of the box, I plugged it into a charger. It took a charge, and I didn't even have to reprogram it or restore it from an Apple image. It had all the memories still there. They had not bothered to wipe it, I guess, because they decided it was broken. So they both worked out. So as far as I'm aware, although I have heard where they swap one phone for another, it wasn't the case for me in this circumstance.
And myself being a suspicious, did you verify the serial number? Now, the reason I'm saying, because I've seen it happen more than once, where you send in serial number XYZ and they send you back serial number PQRX because they just pull them off the shelf. They don't send you back here. In other words, they just don't do that. They would ruin the profit margin. Verify your serial numbers and IMEIs before you send it out and what you get back. Be very careful about that.
If I recall, they don't particularly guarantee that they're going to give you the same model back. I did check the serial number, and as I mentioned, one of the phones still had all my stuff inside its own memory. So I doubt that they would transfer it to another phone that they said was broken. But as far as I'm aware, if they do that to you, unfortunately, they will just say, in the small print, we said we were going to do that. So what's your problem?
Again, the problem being, it might say that in the small print, but what they're doing is they're just taking another rebuilt phone and they're sending it right back to you, and then they're going to take your phone and sell it back to someone else. Be very careful when they do that. Apple has been known to do that. Anyways, that was my comment. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mike. So, David, I hope that we covered your topic tonight.
I just have one postscript. I have a phone, the Talk phone, man's phone, made by a company called Sanum. It's like a brick. It's not thin at all. Batteries you can take out, put in. If this phone breaks, anything wrong with it, any problem with it, I can take the micro SD card out, I can take the SIM out, and I can put it into another phone that I buy for $50. You know, it should work perfectly fine. Even the battery would be compatible for it, you know? Back to you, sir. KG2RY.
Okay, it's good that it has that functionality. It doesn't really need to store that much information because my assumption is it doesn't have a rather large memory. It doesn't have a large cache of applications or such. I mean, with my iPhone, when I got it wiped, all I did was connect it to my Wi-Fi, use my Apple account, download a backup copy that I uploaded right before I turned it off to send it off to Apple, and I was back in business in maybe an hour or two. So 6 of one, half a dozen of the other.
Well, one really good feature for the smartphones, the newer smartphones, is Wi-Fi talk. Wi-Fi talk. You talk over the Wi-Fi network. There is no signal, then you can communicate anyway. But, you know, I find that this really inexpensive network, it works better in my apartment than my Verizon network. And, you know, I don't like to leave the Wi-Fi on all the time in either phone because that's one way to wear out your battery. Back to you.
Well, yeah, if you turn off all the receivers, it drains less power. And iPhones have had that feature for a long while. I'm sure Android does as well. They don't mind you using your own internet service provider and your Wi-Fi connection. It requires less work from their cell phones. And it you know, ultimately it depends upon the carrier, what cell phone towers they use or Wi-Fi connections they use determines areas that are better covered for one company than others. Most likely the company that sells you your phone licenses time on one of the major cell phone companies in the United States. So it's kind of a transparent thing to you, but it's I doubt that they have their own personal cell phone towers.
QSL, Roy. And I suspect that when I had my old Samsung Galaxy Note 4 telephone, that Verizon wanted me to upgrade. They tried their best to get me to upgrade. And the phone became unfunctional on the network. It just didn't work. And I ordered another one from eBay, a refurbished phone, a Note 4, and that also had the same problem because I used the same SIM chip. Anyway, so I get a delivery of this new phone, and I paid, you know, lots of money for it. And the SIM position on the new phone was the same as the old phone, so I had no service through the network. I had to use the Wi-Fi. Then, you know, finally I get the tech support from Verizon to tell me that I have to pull the SIM chip out, wait 10 seconds, and put it back in to reset. What's that all about?
Well, you know, this is the nature of technology. It strikes me as the cell phone version of, have you tried turning it off and turning it on? You know, SIMs are little memory cards. They have data. The newest, the greatest smartphones now have sometimes a real SIM card and a virtual SIM card so that some people can actually use one cell phone for two different contracts or two different telephone lines. But, you know, it's a black art, telecommunications.
Yeah, but it's odd, you know. I pulled the SIM chip out and put it back in, and all of a sudden, the network signal in my apartment for Verizon was working at 100%. Before that, it kept going in and out.
Okay, so I guess it just had to be kind of rebooted, reset. You know, these things happen. I've had situations where I've had Bluetooth devices that just kind of stopped working after linking, and they go in, they go out. So you ask the software to forget them, then you relink them again, and then they're rock stable. Again, you know, electronics, you have to kind of figure it out. Unfortunately, in the old days, all you usually had to do was smack it a couple of times, and things would start working. These little surface mount things usually don't respond terribly well to being smacked, so you have to find a more subtle way around their strangenesses.
Galaxy Note 4 doesn't work in my apartment on Verizon Network. Doesn't matter which one I have in my hand. Say it had something to do with the activation of something on the SIM chip, but who knows? I'll pass it back to you, KG2RY.
Yeah, I need to get going also, WHCDM.
Yeah, Andy, you're next. I just want to thank David and everyone for participating, and please, it is now time for Andy and Andy's Corner.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it's a good subject, talking about batteries. I guess gone are the days when I used to keep a gallon of distilled water in my garage, and a hydrometer. And I think that's what it's called. There was a hygrometer. I think this is a hydrometer for the D. And to measure the specific gravities of the battery in my car. I had to remove each cap. Usually there's 6 caps, and each chamber, you measure the specific gravity, and you want to see how many of those different colored balls float to the top or sink to the bottom. Anyway, those days are long gone. Now that they have sealed batteries and gel cells and whatever they use in cars. Anyway, all right, welcome to... Let me let it drop.
Hold on.